When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Constantly making trips to Home Depot? Introducing Drop, the app that rewards you for every shopping trip. Earn free gift cards for shopping. Download the Drop app now and use code DROP33 to get $5 in points.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now, or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
We're joined by our super guest producer, Max with the Facts Williams. The one they call Ben is currently solving a series of ghoulish riddles to win his voice back from a witch. But you are you. You are here. And that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know.
Is it a sea witch kind of situation? Like a Little Mermaid scenario? I must know more.
Well, to my knowledge, Ben was unable to identify the witch. He just knows that it was, in fact, a witch. Yes.
A dark presence of sorts, not necessarily of the earth or the sea or the sky, you know, specifically.
That's right. Speaking of strange things like that, let's talk about reality, everybody. How do you define reality? How do we define our collective reality? Because so much of what we experience is objectively true. This desk, this microphone, I think I'm looking at a picture of Noel right now as I'm talking to him. I'm pretty sure. But ultimately, much of it is it's a matter of interpretation, right? Our senses taking things in, and then we decide, our brain decides because of previous experience, what reality is.
Well, either interpretation or just like blind faith, right? I mean, through which we filter, you know, into interpretation. It's like, well, I choose to believe that I'm looking at a picture of Noel, because if I don't believe that, or I can't believe that, what can I believe? It's a slippery slope, reality.
Right? It's an interesting thing, this thing we're all experiencing right now, as you are. You. Yes, you. So these are questions that we grappled with in an earlier episode that we recorded in 2021 on a thing called the Latitude Society. It's this intense, astonishing, immersive experience based on a secret society. It pushed the boundaries of art and culture and performance. And today, again, I believe this with all my heart. We are speaking with the creator of a thing called Nonchalance. It's a collective, a company. It's a group that created things, many things, like the Latitude Society. His name is Jeff Hull, and I think I'm looking at him right now. Is that true?
It feels true.
truer words were never spoken, Jeff. Thank you for joining us, man. We're excited to talk through some of your projects, past, present, and future, and just kind of the nature of art and immersive art and virtual reality and augmented. I mean, so many versions of reality that I think we can dive into. So thanks for being here with us.
Oh, likewise. It's really great to be here. I feel like I need to bow before the lords of the unknown.
Yeah, right.
They love a good bow. There's no question about that. And then you will be rewarded.
Well, that's the overlapping area of our interests, is this idea that there's this unknown, and are you willing to explore it?
Oh, exactly. And synchronicity is one major word I just kind of want to focus on today while we're going, you know, while we're having discussion here, because we're talking with you today because of a curious case of synchronicity, some unfolding events, right? We made that episode, and then the Latitude Society and everything we learned about nonchalance and you personally has kind of become just a reference that we call back to quite often, actually, on this show. When we're talking about anything alternate reality or dimensional, things like that, we talk about the Latitude Society, we talk about nonchalance. And my understanding, after we checked our voicemail messages and we heard your voice on there, is that you experienced some weird synchronicity. Could you tell us about that?
Certainly. It was an unreal moment for me when I was in the desert. I was in Joshua Tree, and I had an experience of my own. I was in a kind of a trance psychedelic meditation, and I was considering these questions of participatory projects that can affect our consciousness, our perception of reality. And I was thinking of it in those terms. And then I was, you know, letting the music fade, and I was taking some notes to myself before heading off to sleep. And I put on a podcast, and this night it was Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. And it was the episode of Orrin's Hat. Am I pronouncing it right?
Mm-hmm.
And instantly, you and the other hosts were discussing these projects and these kind of nature of reality and immersive participatory projects. And then you literally uttered the name of Nonchalance and the Latitude, and the synchronicity was just all too much. And I had to call in. I had to call in and tell you about this experience, because it resonated quite profoundly.
I mean, that makes me happy, and also believe in things like the universe, you know, and serendipity and all of that, and being in the right place at the right time. It's always great to feel those connections, and it kind of makes me, it almost like makes you see through the veil a little bit and sort of see the fabric of things and these connections between us. While they can be seen as interpretive or sort of conceptual, I find them more often than not to be pretty real.
That's right. And so Jung talked about synchronicity as not effects that correlate because of causality, but they correlate because of meaning, or another type of correlation than like temporal causality.
Mm. It's so cool to me, because often it feels like, at least personally in my life, I ascribe that to things, right? That's me deciding, oh, well, the universe wanted this to be here or this way. But it is ultimately me deciding to believe that, I guess. I don't know. It's interesting, because what you do with nonchalance and the art that you create and, you know, your teams, it's almost like you're not forcing that synchronicity, but you're allowing a space for it to just occur kind of naturally, that kind of like a bigger meaning amongst something that maybe doesn't necessarily have the meaning, but when the connections are made, it occurs. So if you don't mind, I'd love to just talk about what nonchalance is, what it does, and what an alternate reality game is, and how you view the projects that you create.
So nonchalance began some 22 years ago, really as a street art campaign in Oakland. And As it always is, has existed, it's really a project or initiative that a team is built around, a project or an initiative, right? And then we ramp up into a production, and then that previously has had a life of its own. And so after our last project, we definitely wound down and we're on a hiatus right now. People have gone their own ways, but so it's a really project by project thing where different very talented creators can come together to produce these projects. And so it started off with Oaklandish, a street art campaign really about local lore, Oakland history and roots. And then there was the Jejun Institute, which was kind of our, I guess, our calling card, which was a fictional cult based in downtown San Francisco.
So for the Jejun Institute, I just want to give everybody, make sure they understand the scope of what we're talking about, of these projects, these initiatives. The Jejun Institute felt very real to me when I, because I didn't get to experience it in real time. I didn't get to physically go anywhere or see, you know, physically see anything because I was in Atlanta all the time that it was running. But there are physical spaces that these projects involve and physical, like real things.
Yeah. So the scope of these projects is totally unwieldy and outside of my own control. I am terrible at actually being able to assess the scope of a project. So what seems simple in my mind that, oh, there's going to be an automated room, there's going to be a pirate radio broadcast, there's going to be these micro installations throughout the city, there's going to be some element of augmented reality and events and community building, like, Then comes the work. So yeah, there were flyers and voicemails and signage around the city that were all for kind of metaphysical pseudoscience or fringe sciencey culty things that are a little too bizarre to exist in consensus reality. And then if you were curious enough to follow the breadcrumbs or pull on the thread, you might dial a number or visit a URL or tune into this radio station. They would eventually lead you toward the automated room at 580 California, which was called the Induction Center. And that was meant to be the real inroad to adventure.
Yeah, it's interesting. It kind of reminds me, it's not exactly the same, but there's a band I bet you've heard of called King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. Really cool, psychedelic kind of prog band. Something they do that's interesting to me is that many of their records, they make the like master recordings available for free broadly, you know, and anyone, any small label, anybody that wants to take those masters and put out a bespoke kind of weirdo small press, you know, limited vinyl of it, they can do that. And all that King Gizzard asks is that they send them a copy. So there are all these kind of like sanctioned, like, you know, legal bootlegs of their records floating out there, which kind of creates this participatory atmosphere around their art. And I think that's not only really ingenious in terms of like creating this community around some art, but it's also really practical and interesting in a way of kind of like crowdsourcing the energy of the music or art or culture that you're creating. And it seems like that kind of mentality is somewhat akin to what you're doing with your work. Can you kind of speak to that, the idea of what it means to be participatory as a, you know, as a fan of art, or how you kind of view that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good example, and it kind of points towards the difference between entertainment and art, or the potential for transformation. When you're consuming music or theater or whatever that is, I think our expectations are different than when we are a participant in that experience. So the idea that you could have a creative voice within this project, or you could play a role player. And that's been one of the guiding principles of our projects is there a visceral, tangible aspect to it. It's not just something you listen to. It's not just something you view on a screen. There must be some kind of call to activity, some action that needs to be taken and followed through on. And usually if you are the kind of person who is curious enough to answer the call, as they say, luck favors the bold. There are rewards there.
And with that, we're going to take a quick break, hear a word from our sponsor, and be right back with more from Jeff Hull.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire. Ever wolfed down a Big Mac and thought, I could use some extra cash?
Mm-hmm.
Meet Drop, the ultimate rewards app. Earn free gift cards for getting your daily coffee or late night drive through effortlessly. Just link a card, shop, and watch rewards stack. With Drop, it's like getting paid to indulge. Download Drop now and start earning. Use the code DROP22 for $5 in points instantly.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo!
Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sarge, High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again!
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five!
High Five!
Casino!
Casino!
Win at HighFiveCasino.com!
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
We've returned. Let's get into this. So, okay, in the King Gizzard Lizard Wizard example, they are having this participatory thing. And look, this is my opinion. So they've got this art. They're creating more art with their art. Everyone's enjoying it and doing it together. But in the end, they've got this monetization chain, right? Because the more people listening to their music, the more people hear it, the more people buy it, the more money they're able to make, or their company, whoever they owe money to, gets to make money, which is kind of like in our case.
Just to interject, they own and operate their own label. They are the only ones printing their own records. So,
they're making money.
Yeah.
They're making money,
but you could also argue that doing it this way could take money out of their pocket. But I think it has the opposite effect. It just creates more interest, and it just kind of makes people more invested, you know, in the art. You know, I don't think it's a concern of like hijacking someone's revenue stream per se.
Exactly. But my question then is, like, when you're creating this big project like the Jejun Institute, it doesn't seem, at least to my eyes, that it's for profit. It's like it's almost like you want people to truly have an experience. What is the goal, I guess, your goal when you create something like this?
So, yeah, let me circle back to that. Is King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizards, are they like adjunct to the fish and jam band scene at all?
I mean, they're followed by similar fans, but they're more psychedelic and kind of like they're Australian. They're very like kind of garagey psychedelia, but they definitely have a similar following. They're becoming that level of ubiquitous fame. And honestly, they probably make most of their money with live shows now that people can tour again, but they also come out with about, 10 records a year. They're just incredibly prolific. But just to double down on what Matt's saying as well, like, and just to clarify, your projects, you want people to create their own sub kind of experiences that sort of fit into the ecosystem of your projects, which I think maybe the question is, how does that, is there the potential for that to take away from what you're doing that could be considered a revenue stream or could be considered a business or whatever it is? Like, how do you view that participatory thing in terms of like a business?
Yeah. So there's a few layers to that. One is with the example that you gave of the band who freely gives out all of their tracks and stems for creative productions. What they're creating is meaning for people. Their level of engagement and involvement with their work is very, very personal, and you're building lifelong relationships with that. And so there are other ways to make that a sustainable work other than album sales, right? And so with the Jejun Institute, I didn't know at the time that it would become a documentary directed by Spencer McCall called The Institute, and then that would become the AMC TV series Dispatches from Elsewhere. That was all unanticipated and delightful outcomes, but they lead to other opportunities. And so the Latitude Society was explicitly built for people to build and share experiences with each other. And then there were subsequent projects that we were trying to get off the ground during these very uncertain times to create a platform for participatory play where people can build and create experiences for each other in the real world. That is an ambitious enterprise that just the timing wasn't right. That's the notion, is that through creating these types of magical, realist, tangible experiences that have numinous qualities, that people can learn the language and the tool sets to do it for themselves.
Oh, that's awesome. And at the heart of it, Jeff, is there a philosophy, or is there something you want people to find within there? Because often they're puzzles, and like mm-hmm. you said, you have to want it enough or be curious enough to go a level deeper every time, right? Because these things have depth to them. Is there something at the heart, like of the Jejun Institute, that you wanted people to take away?
Absolutely. And that central guiding light, I think, is the same throughout, but it evolves and it takes different forms. So at the very beginning, there was this sense of playfulness, this idea that as adults we had sacrificed our ability to play with each other. And play has a very specific purpose in not just human life, but mammalian life, and perhaps beyond that. Play is something that is meaning-making. We create a magical circle of understanding in which different rules apply. And so I was looking at civic spaces in downtown San Francisco, particularly, and saying, why have we sacrificed this element of play? Why is everything all down to business? Why is it shopping and commuting and drinking a latte? And how come all of the other spaces that are in a civic society, we need spaces for dialogue, for communion, for play. And it seemed like through a lot of different influences in the culture, those spaces were diminished and diminished and diminished. So from that vantage, it's like we're trying to solve a specific problem. And then I learned that play takes on all these different qualities for people, that it goes way beyond just this idea of a game and being playful, that there's a lot of kind of strata beneath there.
Well, and it can go a little too far too, can't it? with it, run amok, you know, like that's sort of what the Institute's about. The sort of unintended, I don't know, we'll call them consequences, I guess, for lack of a better word, of your open-endedness to this project. The idea of inviting people to join sort of a secret society, the Latitude Society, and while I think your intent was more this sort of immersive, choose-your-own-adventure kind of scavenger hunt, I think because it had this sort of inherent kind of exclusivity to it with the invites and stuff, that people started to kind of make it their own and feel like they had agency to control the narrative rather than just go along with it or explore what you'd kind of laid out before them. And it sort of kind of made the whole thing become a bit of a bummer for you, if I'm not mistaken. Can you kind of talk about that aspect? You kind of accidentally invented the thing you were making fun of, which was like a cult. Not invented, yeah, but there's... created. You created a version of it sort of accidentally by doing a really damn good parody of it, because you sort of proved the rule you were trying to lampoon a little bit, which is that people tend to take these things on and make it part of their identity. And I think a lot of people didn't get the joke.
Right. So the answer to that question, again, layers here. I've suffered very real consequences from doing this kind of work, and there has been consequences and results that are unintended. And I can take accountability for a great deal of that in this regard. When we create a fake religion or a fake cult or an institute, or that we kind of like put these plaques and invite these alternate realities or alternate histories or narratives, we are playing upon archetypal energies within ourselves and others. And archetypes are sometimes conscious things and sometimes they're unconscious things. And so I think that I, at that time, through naivete, nonchalance could be a synonym for naivete. You know, that's a quality of this, this idea of like, I don't know, let's see what could go wrong. And I f***ed around and found out what can go wrong.
I love that expression.
So, yeah, the idea that we're playing upon archetypal subconscious energies that activate us in ways that we don't understand or that we're not fully aware of is something I can take accountability for. And I think the community around the Institute and the Latitude Society also were activated in this primordial way that I could describe as the religious impulse.
Oh man, the religious impulse is very strong right now, it feels, in society. And people are just down to call pretty much anything a religion, or feel like anything is a religion right now.
Isn't that funny too, Matt? Because you'd think that the kind of people that would be into something like what Jeff's creating would be people that wouldn't necessarily gravitate towards religion. But I think, to Jeff's point, it is something that is inherent within all of us. And when you summon these kind of archetypes, they can resonate in a way that people aren't even aware. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like just because I'm not a religious person doesn't mean I don't seek answers or seek, you know, some kind of justification or like explanation for why things are the way they are, or some sort of way of exploring those questions. I think everybody sort of wants that. And if you're, you know, given that gateway, it's hard not to want to step through.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me, though, Jeff. I don't know what it's like to be immersed that deeply in one of the experiences, right? Because unless I'm in one right now and I'm just unaware of it, which very well could be, maybe this is just a nonchalance production, but I'm imagining when somebody goes into one of these experiences and you're going down that rabbit hole, wouldn't people have some sense that this is a game or something else? Or is it just so well, you know, cloaked within reality that people do go down the rabbit hole that deeply? Is that, do you think that's what it is?
So I don't think it's cloaked that deeply. And I can speak to, you know, how these events reverberate in people to that depth. But first, I actually want to back up, Noel, to what you were saying about what we give our attention to is what we are worshiping. We're all worshiping something. So if you're staring at your screen for 3+ hours a day, that's what you are worshiping. And so whether we decide to intentionally worship something or not, we have that impulse to give our attention to something that is, maybe it's greater than ourselves. Maybe it provides meaning. And people are so thirsty right now for meaning. So that's why we see these things like QAnon or Nexium coming up. People are pulled in these ways. And that's why we're seeing this bizarre tribalism. And it also speaks to why these kinds of projects are not very timely at the moment. We already are in a place that we can't trust reality. So there's no room to cavalierly suggest an alternative reality that's playful and without consequences. There's really not the space for that right now. And so that's why the nature of these projects, and I think even the immersive arts realm is waning.
Mm.
Immersivity will continue in VR and AR and the commodification of all those things, but this kind of live participatory role play game aspect, I don't think there's a solid ground for it at the moment because of the degradation of truth.
That's an interesting perspective. I'd love to just double back on Matt's question real quick about you saying your experience isn't that deeply veiled, that anyone paying attention should kind of get a sense, okay, this is entertainment. I would argue there are companies like Punch Drunk and Meow Wolf and stuff like that that are doing similar things, but you buy a ticket. You know, when you go see Sleep No More, it's immersive and it is highly psychedelic and very affecting, but you pay a couple hundred bucks for that ticket. And I know you pay it something or get a pass for your thing, but it feels a little different than going on a website, buying a ticket and then showing up for a showtime. Can you speak a little bit to some of those handlings of immersive entertainment and how you handle it and kind of what makes your thing different from some of those, like, you know, the Punch Drunks of Meow Wolves of the world?
Yeah. Those are great touchstones, because Meow Wolf and Punch Drunk have very successfully built these experiences that are very meaningful for people and they're very sustainable. And they are turnstile events. They are events where you there's a designated space and time for these, and there's a transactional quality that you enter into them and then you exit from. And therefore, that reality bending element is it's handled very specifically. And I think one of the lessons that I've come away with is that I used to celebrate what was opaque and unknown and mysterious and really, really want as much of that as possible in my projects. And I wanted people to kind of fill in the blanks themselves. And that place of not knowing which part of it is real and which part of it isn't, is this overlapping of, it's a superimposition upon the magical realist world and then the reality on the ground, right? Or the factual history of this building and the invented history of this building. And then this area where they overlap is called the warp zone. It's a place of departure. It's a place that you don't really know what the boundaries are between the actual and the fantastical. And so it creates a perception that is different of reality, where we just don't know the limits of this thing. When somebody walks right up to you on a busy street and hands you the placard that you've been looking for that has the next thing, and then suddenly you're looking at every other person on the street and saying, are they in on it? You're in the warp zone. You're in a place of departure.
Okay, let's take a quick pause. We're going to hear a word from our sponsor, and then we'll be back with more conversation with Jeff Hull.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Is getting gas at Shell burning a hole in your wallet? What if I told you can easily earn cash back while you fill up? Introducing Drop, the app that turns every fill up into a reward. With Drop, you'll earn points to get free gift cards every time you fill up your tank. Download Drop and use code DROP88 to instantly receive $5 in points to jumpstart your savings journey. Don't miss out on turning your gas expenses into something rewarding.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo!
Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sort. High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again.
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five.
High Five.
Casino.
Casino.
Win at High Five Casino.
.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
And we're back. Let's get right back into it.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a concrete example that just happened to me as we were prepping for this episode. Okay, when you go to the website for Signal, S-Y-G-N-Y-L, this is an audio experience that you've created. It's very cool, by the way. You have to check it out. Don't listen to the Signal. Whatever you do, don't listen to the Signal. There is a short dedication at the bottom of the primary page when you go there. I'm going to read it to you and just show you where I went. It says, A General Mystification Volume 1, which is kind of the subtitle for Signal, or at least for the first season. It says, is dedicated to the memory of James Bauer and Tony Shea, our intangible kin. And now James' name links out to a GoFundMe page. And Tony's name links out to a memorial fund. And for me, as I was going through and really studying the Signal, downloading the stuff, looking at all the materials that are available, listening to the episodes, I didn't see that about me or that part of the page until later in my exploration. I was fully 100% convinced that that was part of Signal, that everything that I was reading was false, that this was like, as you know, part of the game world. I didn't know Tony or James, so I didn't know if they were actually, you know, deceased or not. So I fully, for I would say a couple hours this week, believed that this thing called Moon Ridge Foundation, which is handling Tony's, I guess, his fund, I thought it was fake. I was looking through their website, reading the bios of their directors, like trying to figure out, okay, who in here is actually a piece back to Signal? I just telling that to you just to show you how cloudy even my judgment gets when I was trying to research this episode today.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And that is the kind of thing I think happens. It's powerful when it happens because suddenly reality takes on a different quality to it. Tony Shea and James Bauer are actual friends of mine who passed away right before I went into producing the Signal. And
I'm sorry, I know it wasn't even really a question, Jeff. I just wanted to give you an example of like me just being confused.
Yeah. it can be really, really confusing. It can be very confusing. And so that kind of data parsing of like, I'm going to go on this site and I'm going to find out who this is and I'm going to follow these links and I'm going to collect information and I'm going to analyze it. That is one of the ways these games or these experiences can challenge you. And there's a lot of different ways that they can challenge you. One of them is creatively. One of them is analytically. One of them is socially. They can be physically challenging. They can be psychologically challenging. And they can be existentially challenging. And I think you guys and your audiences might lean in towards psychological and experiential or existential challenges. But a lot of people are really into that analytical puzzle solving, ciphers, data, code, clues, puzzles, and they lean into the analytical challenge. And they might lean away from this being challenged psychologically. And it's just an interesting quality of the groups of people that these projects are like a magnet towards.
Oh, dude, I would describe myself as psychologically challenged in general.
Fair. But also, I think you're a fan of being, you know, psychologically challenged and then experiencing things that are challenging. I wanted to bring this up because both you and I, I think possibly you to a deeper degree, are very into a game called Elden Ring. Jeff, you may have heard of it. It's kind of the biggest game going right now. I know I've heard you on some podcasts say you're not really a gamer. You have to, I imagine, understand some basis of game theory to even be able to join all these pieces together and make these experiences fun and engaging and challenging, but not so challenging that you're going to lose people. But Elden Ring is interesting because this company From Software, they're kind of known for making like really, really difficult games. And this is their first like open world kind of version of these really difficult games. And within that, it requires you to really get your ducks in a row and like really like learn to get good at the game because there's no easy mode. But also it has all of this lore for you to parse that if you really want to experience it on that next level, it's all hidden in like object descriptions of like, you know, a sword or even like a resource, like a berry or something. And it's so vast and a little bit esoteric and kind of like, you know, ephemeral that it's easy to completely ignore that level of it. But I think that's a layer that, you know, it creates all of this chatter. It creates, you know, there's just dozens and dozens of videos on YouTube of people trying to parse all this Elden Ring lore, even if they haven't even quite fully figured it out. I was just wondering if you see any analogs between something like that, that is more of a traditional role-playing game, but it has sort of like an open-ended quality to it, similar to what you're doing, or do you think there's really not much connection between like game design for like, you know, video games and the kind of work that you do with these kind of real world or internet kind of connected games?
So I've become a student of game theory and some people writing on that subject, even though I'm not a gamer myself. And I think that those kinds of narratives and mythological functions of a game, like, so myths themselves have a lot of different functions to them. And so the mythological function of a game is something I feel very, very connected to, especially when that lore is richly rewarding and correlated to something that's meaningful or potentially enlightening or transformational or something like that. Like we all use formulas and tropes when we're creating our worlds and our stories. And hopefully those formulas and tropes and all of that content can add up to something greater than the sum of its parts. I don't know if that answered your question or not, but I'm definitely going to check out the Elden Ring.
I think you should. And Matt, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this because, and again, I just mentioned that, you know, you've been a fan of this company's games for a long time, and they really do differentiate themselves because so many other, I guess, Western game design companies that do these supposedly open-ended, open-world RPGs, it feels like you're looking at a GPS where it's guiding you, telling you exactly where to go, exactly what object to pick up. It's all like homework assignments, but Elden Ring doesn't do that. There's no guide. There's nothing telling you where to go. There's no hints, really, except from community members. There's this online component where people can drop little kind of very vague clues because you can only use certain words. But Matt, I'd love to hear if you think there's any connection between that world and what we're talking about here today.
Yeah, certainly, because in those games, you can only know what you know in any given moment, and then you add a piece of information to that, and now that becomes what you know, right? It's very much what happens in the real world. I know my yard. I know the areas that I travel to on a regular basis. I understand the things that are transmitted to me through, you know, this screen when I'm searching for them. But anything I don't search for, any place I don't travel to, I have absolutely no understanding in the real world terms, right? And then in these video games, you kind of function in the same way, because if it's an open world game, you just explore and travel. Then when I'm thinking about something like, I don't know, I guess I would just say it's like the Latitude Society's, the myth at the heart of the Latitude Society. How everything in that myth exists inside the book, right? There was a book that you could travel down physically to and then hear the story that's within this book, which I think it was like a projector or something. It looked so incredible, however you did it. Awesome work. But then everyone else who came along added to that myth or added, I guess, their own concept to that myth, right? That's kind of what happened. I'm just talking nonstop here, but yeah, ultimately it feels like there is some connection to there. I'm just not smart enough to put the pieces together, if you will.
And also, I mean, to your point about the Latitude Society's central mythology, I don't know. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, Jeff. Like, I mean, is there an end-all, be-all answer, or is it kind of all up for interpretation? Because this Elden Ring lore, there's really no hard and fast. I mean, there maybe is, but even like if you have the answer, it's all pretty cloaked in mystery and these kind of esoteric concepts that aren't really instantly attainable to even fully wrap your head around. I feel like there's some of that in Latitude Society where, you know, your central mythology isn't necessarily designed to have an end-all, be-all final answer that, yes, this is what everything is. Here are all the pieces. Now you don't have to wonder anymore. I think it's all about the wondering to me.
Yeah, so that parallels a lot of philosophies, theologies, and ideologies. It's like you can study and you can become the monk who knows all of the scriptures. And ultimately, there is, I think, when we're talking about those things, there's something you're going to find within yourself. There's this interior journey, and there's a lot of unknowable qualities that are open to interpretation and will always remain open to interpretation. That's part of the human mystery. So if your game world can parallel that kind of quest, then I think you're onto something. You're cooking.
You should check out another game, Jeff. It's called Control. It came out years ago. Mm-hmm. It's from, I think, Remedy Entertainment. Oh, Lord, let me look that up. Yes, it is Remedy Entertainment. Came out 2019, maybe?
Okay.
And it does some of the same stuff that you do with lore, where you get bits and pieces, you go deeper, you find the next bit, and it matches up with this other thing. But if you don't look back at the other piece to connect those pieces together, then there's no meaning. The meaning only occurs when you combine, like, concepts, I guess. And I think you'd get a kick out of it.
So I'll check that out. So to go back to the question at hand a little bit, like, is there a specific outcome or specific interpretation of these things? I think that book and projection is a good analogy, because what it was attempting to do was represent the different modes of storytelling that we have. It started from oral traditions, sitting around a campfire and talking, and then those stories get passed on. Then became the printing press, right? There's a written language and then printing and reproduction, right? So that's the book. But then when we projected the image onto the book, we're taking it into an age of technology, an age of immersive experiential storytelling, right? And the purpose of that story was to let people know that there is a rich history to your own experience, that you're part of a greater story, and that if you, so this is the other part to that, that other level. After you went through that initiatory experience, you would be invited to praxis meetings and events in these clandestine locations. And it would always begin with a telling of the fable from memory. So it would always be a little bit different. And then we would play games where people would add on to the story and imagine all the things that happened between that initial origin story and what's happening today. And by that activity, you become a storyteller yourself. And I would say that's closing the loop of the endeavor. You were initiated into a space and heard a story, and you become the teller of the story. You become the hero of the journey, and you're passing that on to others.
Well, it's just, you know, it's the honoring of the oral tradition too, and the way things kind of evolve over time as they're passed down, and you're sort of inviting people to be a part of that, like, up front. And I think that's why it's so interesting to me to go back to something I asked about earlier, how people were able to get so kind of bent out of shape when they didn't like the direction things were going. People that really took this stuff on and used it as a way of kind of defining their personalities, I think, beyond what you'd ever intended. Can you just talk a little bit about what kind of that backlash was and why you almost kind of shut it down, at least for all intents and purposes, when these meetings started getting a little aggressive, where people were kind of like, no, that's not what happens. This is what happens.
Yeah, that element that I was talking about, it's like, oh, here's a mythology, you're being invited in, there's this place where you belong, and now you're the storyteller too. It goes back to what we were talking about, like this connecting on a unconscious and archetypal level. And I had no idea how powerful that was going to be for people. I really had no idea. And also, I'm not the type of person who seeks belonging in the same way. I'm not like trying to find this inner circle or this quest, because I already have a very meaningful, when I talk about community, to me, I'm talking about people I've known for 40 years, you know, people I, you know, generations deep in California. I have 7 sisters in the Bay Area, and I'm not seeking a sense of belonging in that way. And so I vastly underestimated the power and the quest for not just belonging, but meaning. This is a meaning-making activity. And so this is brings us to like, where is this going now? Because when you use these tools to create a fiction, when you use these tools to create an entertainment, there is a sense of enchantment that's very, very strong. Enchantment is like this enticing, delightful sense of like a mystique. It's gesturing towards the numinous. It is pointing towards the moon, but it is not the moon. The moon is actual magic. And now we need to differentiate between enchantment and magic, right? So we're using the tools to create something that is it's an enchantment. That's what I was doing, because I didn't know that you could actually transform people's lives with this. I didn't take that with the gravity and the seriousness that perhaps I could have. And so when people are enchanted into a world, there is the inevitable factor of disenchantment. And with disenchantment can come a sense of betrayal. And with a sense of betrayal, there can become a sense of loss. And when you have a group experiencing that all at the same time, it becomes righteous indignation. All things that I was in no way prepared to manage or to be a leader in that place. I put myself into a leadership position that I was not prepared for in any way.
There is a documentary that you can watch right now. It's titled In Bright Axiom, B-R-I-G-H-T and then A-X-I-O-M. It kind of details what occurred. What I want to know from you, Jeff, is, was that fully reality when I'm watching that documentary, or was that a part in some way of the Latitude Society?
So 95%, I don't know, 93% of the whole film is like actual factual interviews. And then we do play with the narrative, and that's what makes these films really fun. Spencer McCall has been very inventive about taking that idea of a warp zone and applying it to the cinematic platform. The dark stuff and the reactionary stuff and the bitter, bitter resentment is not even begun to be touched at in that film. That film was concluded before the real backlash and the real accusations and the real destructive bad faith acting that came out as a result of the film. And so I almost wish we caught it in the film, because the amount of pathos and drama that occurred is still there. It's still there. It's still just this bitter, bitter thing for people.
You know, it's so interesting, though. I was trying to come up with the term, and then you said it right away, the warp zone. Isn't that space, though, where people aren't sure how invested they should be? Isn't that the warp zone? Like where they kind of get, they lose the plot and sort of get too immersed and start like drinking the Kool-Aid for real instead of like just kind of realizing it's a performance. Like, isn't that sort of what you're after? But it just sort of maybe blew up a little bit in a way that you weren't expecting. But like ultimately, it seems like that's kind of the magic of all of this when it's done.
I think this is the great analogy for me when I was talking about, well, how are these experiences like really transformative and meaningful? It's like, in my personal life, my boundaries, it's taken me a long, long time to learn like the boundaries. What are the boundaries? What am I up for? What am I not? What am I willing to do? I'm not able to do for you, you know? And so the Latitude Society is a great teacher for me about that. I left the boundaries wide open. And you can have the mystique. You can have your cake and eat it too. You can create numinous experiences with a mystique and mystery and everything like that, but you don't have to lay down the drawbridge and give people the keys to the kingdom on the first date. You don't need to do that.
That makes sense.
But how am I ever going to get all the way up this bridge that I just started on? I'm just joking.
See?
I'm just joking.
Matt, I that's interesting, because I mean, to me, and I think probably to all three of us here, I mean, you know, Scientology is so clearly a thing from the mind of a creative writer, and I use that term very loosely, creative writer. And it was, you know, kind of created in his image with all of these tropes from science fiction. Like, how does it go so far? You know, it's because nobody checked it, and he wanted it to. He just allowed it to happen. Like, I would argue that maybe L. Ron Hubbard didn't necessarily think Scientology was going to go as far as it went, but when he started seeing it going in that direction, instead of pumping the brakes like you did, he just kind of rolled with it. I don't know. Maybe I'm overreaching here, but I'm interested to hear what both of you guys think about that.
I think that's an accurate description of what likely has happened with Scientology. There was a fiction, there was a recognition that there was a need there for people. There was an odyssey that was created in mythology. And these things are so powerful that they take on a life of their own. They have a power that is beyond any individual in that organization. And so now you're talking about godlike powers. And which is the function of mythology and religion in the first place. There is a power that is beyond our own power.
Yes. But see, these are mythological powers, and it's contained within a group of people who choose to believe, right? Or do fully believe, right?
Now they suspend disbelief.
There you go. There you go. But what happens when that kind of mythos is built up around, let's say, a political campaign, right? Or something that does have real world actual effects on human beings and real consequences. And not that a religion doesn't have real consequences, and not that Scientology hasn't had real consequences, but I mean, far reaching global consequences when, let's say, a new president comes into power and there's a mythos that's built up around that just through a campaign, right? I don't know, like, what happens then? Because it feels like we've been experiencing that for a while now.
Matt, that's the world we're living in. You just described the world we're living in. Not what happens. You're looking at what happens. But you're seeing it.
You made such a good point, though, Jeff, earlier, kind of commenting on that, about how it's hard to play in these quote-unquote virtual spaces out in the world because everything feels that way and nothing is to be believed. So it's like, you know, we're living in this post-truth world. It's sort of a buzz term, but I think it applies here, where it's all fake news, you know, on both sides. And it's almost like we just talked to, who's that guy we talked to, Matt, the lovely British journalist who wrote about kind of belief and cautionary tales.
Tim Harford.
He pointed out that, you know, when you're living like conspiracy theorists and people that like really go all in on conspiracy theorists, to them, it's not about belief so much as it's about disbelief. It's about like, I choose to follow the person who's telling me not to believe this other person. And so inherent in that is sort of this lack of belief in anything. And it sort of causes this weird stymieing of like forward momentum and thought and culture. And it's really scary. Sorry. I don't know.
It is. Yeah. I don't have anything succinct to say about that, but I'm following you 100%.
Well, I guess we'll just have to find some kind of experience to like get a catharsis, to achieve a crystallized moment, right? How do we do that, though?
That's a great question. And so this catharsis that you're talking about is something that human beings really need to reckon with the exact world that you described. It's a unraveling of a common narrative. It's the ground of what we perceive as truth has just deteriorated underneath us, and the world is no longer what we knew. And so before we can bring in a new era, we need to mourn the death of the world that we knew. And there hasn't been an experience that I know of that is adequately answering that in a cultural way, in a performative way, in a ritual, in a ceremonial way. And I think there's a way to do that. I'm actively working on these ideas right now. And it's more of a procession or a pageantry that is performative, but the takeaway and the layer that I think is maybe a new direction is cultivating and developing the choreography of a cathartic and wordless experience that involves music and role playing. And when I say wordless, I mean prelingual. This is something that can affect us in our bodies, in our hearts, and it can resonate in our sensory capacities. But when we apply language to it, that gets attached to mythology and these archetypal ideas of ideology, theology, and it gives this kind of a container or this fixation around ideas and beliefs and words and ideologies. And that's what we're all wrapped up in, and these distrust of other people's beliefs and ideas. Well, there is a place beyond beliefs and ideas. And I think that's what you were speaking to, of like, what is this cathartic experience? So these are some of the ideas I'm playing around with right now and seeking collaborators for.
Oh, wait. Oh, no. You're seeking collaborators? Oh, that's dangerous for me. No.
I mean, I will say, you know, to that point, you know, I find catharsis in music. I find catharsis in cinema. I find catharsis in literature, and the combination of all of those things, which I think is largely what you're doing. So I think there's obviously real value in there. It's like, can changing someone's brain or the way we interpret the world around us actually lead to substantive change in the way people interact with the world? Like, I have a daughter who's 13 and thinks everything is fucked, but also has a lot of hope. And I see that and see the way she interprets art and how important music and literature and culture and all these things are to her. And I see the lessons she's learning and how sponge-like she and her kind of generation are in absorbing these things. And I see some hope. I don't know. I don't know if like I can direct. All I can do is talk on this podcast and maybe make a record, you know, with the music that I like to do. Matt and I make music together as well, that maybe will change someone's opinion or someone's mind. That's all I can, I think, hope to do. But I think there are future generations that are just so much smarter, so much younger than I certainly was. And I just wanted to know what your thoughts are on, like, on that, on how younger generations have access to the wealth of human knowledge and the wealth of human art and culture, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing or kind of a mixed bag, and what you see for the future of like the next generation, how they might be able to make a difference substantively.
Yeah, that's the biggest one, isn't it? I've got a teenager too and a young daughter, and they have a similar vantage on the world right now. And it seems like there's a lot of doom and gloom in the narrative, and it's real. And I think it kind of goes back to that sense of like, yes, there needs to be major change in all of our policies and all of the way we do things as institutions. And we're getting into like major global climate, economic issues like that. And it starts with what you're doing right now. Your podcast leads people to the right questions at the very least. And the right answers, and the way that you discuss it in such a kind of a genuine, thorough way is really admirable. And that's what I love about the podcast. That's what my wife loves about the podcast. And so, you know, you guys are cultural creators, right? You've chosen that realm. It's not directly political, but it is a chance for people to engage with meaningful content. And so the kids are going to do something totally unexpected. They're going to continue to do that. And they're going to do things that we don't even understand. But we're hopefully providing them with stories that involve the challenges. The stories we're telling involve the challenges. It involves going into that cave that we fear to enter and coming out with the boon and being able to share it with others. And it goes back to that individual journey of like being able to like really reckon with what we're most afraid of in ourselves, and then being able to come out and give something to others. So I know that's seems like platitudes, but with the enormity of the issues going on, and we are just these little individuals, it's like, I think that's the challenge at hand, is to look inward and to come out and contribute.
Well, I don't accept any of the kind things that you just said to us, towards us, but the other stuff, right on.
Yes, you do, Matt. You accept it, and you're grateful. No.
As am I. They shall be omitted. They're redacted.
Man, Jeff, the concept you described just a few moments ago sounds so exciting to me. I was joking about being afraid of being a part of it. I just know I'm one of those people that would Fox Mulder down the rabbit hole of whatever it is. And even if I helped create it, I would be all in. I don't want to be that guy. But I know everyone out there listening is very excited just to hear, to see, and experience whatever the next thing is that you work on, just as I am. Thank you so much for joining us.
So for a great kind of central location to check out everything that Jeff and his collaborators are working on, head on over to nonchalance.com. That's nonchalance.com. From there, it links out to Oaklandish, kind of the sort of like original concept that led to the Lejeune Institute, which led to the Latitude Society, which led to the Signal Project that we talked about, the kind of audio experience of all this. And they're all kind of fingers on a hand or branches on a tree. And the design of all these pages is beautifully obscure and like kind of at first, like, what even am I looking at? But if you want to go to that website, nonchalance.com, click on the icon at the top and it gives you a link to all of these other sites. And they're like, I mean, they honestly, Jeff, they remind me of the kind of experimental websites of yesteryear. I'm trying to think of a few, but there were some really cool ones that just used like text and image overlays. These don't feel like particularly like web 3.0 or whatever. Like there's a cool analogness to all of your designs, and yet they still feel like you're interfacing with some weird esoteric machine that also kind of is sentient in some way. I like the whole vibe of these pages. And if you want to just do a dive into some of these sites, you're going to spend some time because each one of them is kind of a game in and of itself, just the website.
I got to tip my hat to designer Linda Dong, who was able to synthesize all that content into this vision, which did have that, you know, low key retro tech aesthetic to it. She really delivered on that site.
Definitely. No, it's beautiful stuff. They're kind of works of art in and of themselves, and we'll give you tons of places to go. Also, Matt, the documentary as well, where can people stream that?
Well, I found it just through a Google search. In Bright Axiom, you can find it streaming, I think, in several places still. I remember when we watched it for the Latitude Society episode, it was available widely.
And then also the AMC series that was based on that is available on Hulu, presumably, and AMC if you have a subscription to that. And I actually was not aware of that. And I love the cast. It's got some really cool folks in it. Jason Segel and some other, and Andre 3000, AT Alien from right here. So very much looking forward to checking that one out as well.
Yeah, Matt and Noel, this has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate the time to chop it up with you guys. Let's do it again.
For sure.
In the meantime, if you would like to find us as a show, you can do so. We are all over the internet, anywhere you get internet.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, where we are Conspiracy Stuff. On Instagram, we are Conspiracy Stuff Show. Just a little extra show in there. If you don't like social media, we understand. Trust us. You can instead use your phone for its intended purpose.
That's right. You can call 1-833-STDWYTK, just like Jeff did. Take a page out of his book. Leave us a message. Let us know what to call you, what not to call you. Give us permission to use your voice, and boom, you might hear yourself on one of our weekly listener mail episodes. If you don't want to do any of that stuff, we've got another option for you. You can write us a good old-fashioned email where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Tired of routine Walgreens trips? Get rewarded for shopping with Drop. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards on groceries, gas, and more. Download Drop now and use code DROP55 to get $5 in points. Join Drop today.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Yeah!
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your high-five moment today? Only at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Attention, true crime enthusiast. Searching for a way to unwind after diving deep into the mysteries that keep you up at night? Look no further.
Introducing Lazarus Naturals, your trusted companion for CBD relief. With a commitment to transparency, Lazarus Naturals oversees every step from farm to doorstep, ensuring purity and quality you can trust.
Visit LazarusNaturals.com today and discover how CBD can help you decompress and recharge for your next investigation.
That's LazarusNaturals.com.
Lazarus Naturals, your partner in unraveling the mysteries of true crime.
Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Dealing with pests can be a pain, but relax, Terminix can help.
Because when pests show up, so does Terminix.
With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast.
If your home or business has pests, don't stress it.
Terminix it.
Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today.
That's TERMINIX.com.